All right, Lecture 10 of the Staying Connected, Selected Talks and Meditations by Rudolf Steiner. Again, these are edited lectures. This is Lecture 10, which was given in Berlin on March 19th, 1918. It's called The Feeling of Community and the Experience of Gratitude and the Introduction. I believe this is all by Christopher Bamford, but I'm not sure. Yeah, introduced by Christopher Bamford. The dead already live. The future conditions of human existence, which Steiner calls quote-unquote Jupiter existence. This makes their functioning somewhat more difficult to understand than the spiritual beings whose nature we can understand, in a certain sense, by reading descriptions of them. Nevertheless, communion with the dead is possible, and since we are also preparing for our future conditions, such communication is part of our evolutionary task. From this point of view, the first capacity to be acquired is a quote, feeling of community, unquote, with everything that exists. This feeling of community with the world must become a concrete experience in our lives. We must come to realize that we leave our mark on all that we encounter, and that we remain connected in our subconscious with everything with which we come into contact. This fact also underlies karma. It provides the basis for our general feeling of community with the world. We are able to have this feeling because we have left our mark everywhere. As we become aware of this, we also become conscious of the invisible bond that unites all things. This feeling of community with everything is fundamental for both Jupiter existence and the life of the dead. For the most part, we lack any real sense of this today. We live primarily for ourselves. We have no sense that the welfare of the individual, when it has nothing to do with the welfare of the community, has no justification. This must become the fundamental principle of ethics. We are all connected. We must begin to understand the sense in which humanity constitutes a single organism. If we can begin to understand this, to develop a sense of community, we can begin to live with others as if they were ourselves. The ability to attune so closely to another that we can think, feel, and imagine acting as they do is a great aid in establishing the larger community of the living and the dead. One way to do this is to re-experience a shared event from the other's point of view. Only from this place of community can the dead bring themselves into our consciousness, for they can speak only toward this, quote, place of community, unquote. Of course, it is necessary to hear what they speak as they speak it. For this, Rudolf Steiner tells us we must pay attention to the, quote, unquote, air between us and the dead. There must be a medium, an intermediary. The creation of this medium can begin with a mood of gratitude. Subconsciously, we already experience this sense of gratitude for every impression life brings us. Subconsciously, we receive each impression as a gift. We must pay attention to this sense of gratitude beneath the surface of our consciousness. As we do this, we begin to realize that the sense of gratitude is linked to the awareness that we are dreaming all the time. Beneath waking life, dream life continues. And through this dream element, the dead can begin to speak. They speak into the, quote, intimate subconscious perceptions that occur on their own, unquote, for which we must be grateful, and which, in a sense, we discover through the practice of gratitude itself. Ultimately, in fact, we are led to the conviction that all of life is a gift. Within our conviction that life is a gift, the dead find a sure and common ground with us. Hence, we cannot find and develop the feeling of gratitude the dead read that again. Hence, if we cannot find and develop the feeling of gratitude, the dead cannot find us. The Feeling of Community and the Experience of Gratitude, given in Berlin, March 19th, 1918. Ellipsis. We always have a relationship to the spiritual world, and we always have a certain relationship with those among the dead who are karmically united with us. Nevertheless, it is one thing to speak of the reality of such a relationship, and another to speak of the degree of awareness we may have in relation to it. It is important for everyone, even those who feel quite remote from any awareness of such a relationship, to experience what those who have this consciousness speak of, because they are realities that always surround us. We must clearly understand, however, that the relationship between the so-called living and the so-called dead is in some ways more difficult to bring to awareness than is our relationship to other beings of the spiritual world. Through seeing inwardly, it is easier to become aware of beings of the higher hierarchies. and even to find them distinctly revealed, then to become aware of a definitive relationship with those who have died, that is, to become truly conscious of them in the right way. This is because between death and rebirth we pass through states that are very different from our life's relationships in the physical world. Just look at the course of lectures on the life between death and rebirth. You can see that in speaking of life after death we must use thoughts and concepts that are quite different from those we apply to the physical world. Footnote: Rudolf Steiner, The Inner Nature of Man and the Life Between Death and Rebirth, London, Rudolf Steiner Press, 1994. These have been read onto tape, as a matter of fact. Why must they be so different? Because between death and rebirth, we anticipate, as it were, certain conditions that will manifest as conditions of life only during the Earth's next embodiment, the phase of cosmic evolution termed Jupiter. During our evolutionary stage, a person's experiences between death and rebirth anticipate the life conditions of the Jupiter stage of evolution, though in a form more subtle and spiritualized. In our present earthly lives, we retain something of the Earth's earlier moon, sun, and Saturn embodiments. Likewise, during our life between death and rebirth, we receive something that is part of the future. The beings of the higher hierarchies, on the other hand, to the degree that we can examine them with human perception, are naturally united, immediately and presently, with the whole spiritual world as it now passes through a particular form. In the future, they will reveal the future. Although this may sound contradictory, it is a fact. It sounds paradoxical, because we must ask, how can the beings of the higher hierarchies actively affect the dead, if the dead already bear something of the future within themselves? Of course, the beings of the higher hierarchies also carry something of the future within themselves and are able to shape it. But they also shape something that is immediately characteristic of the present. Therefore, a perception of what the higher hierarchies accomplish constitutes a preparation for becoming aware of communication with those who have died. Not until we have brought about a more or less conscious perception in our soul of the beings of the higher hierarchies will it be possible for us gradually to become conscious through our faculties of perception and feeling of anything having to do with communication with the dead. I do not mean that we must become aware of the higher hierarchies in a clairvoyant way, but we must understand what flows into existence from them to the degree that spiritual science makes this possible. In all these things, it is our understanding that is primary. If we take the trouble to understand the hierarchies through spiritual science, conditions of existence can certainly arise that call up something like a union of the so-called living with the so-called dead. If we wish to understand this, however, we must remember that the spiritual world, in which human beings dwell between death and rebirth, has its own special conditions of existence, conditions we can scarcely imagine in our ordinary earthly lives. They sound strange and paradoxical when presented to us as part of a general picture. Mostly, we must remember that one who wishes to experience such things with awareness must acquire something we might call a feeling of community with everything in existence, a requirement for our continued spiritual evolution from our own disastrous time on, is that we gradually develop this feeling of community with all that exists. A lower variation of this feeling is well established in the human subconscious. We must not, however, chatter pantheistically about some quote-unquote universal spirit. We must not speak of some general feeling of unity. We must be clear, concrete, and specific about how to speak of it, and how it is gradually established in the soul, because this feeling of unity is an experience in life. We often hear that criminals, in whom instinctive subconsciousness works very strongly, have a peculiar urge after committing a crime. They are drawn back to the scene of the crime. A vague feeling drives them to return. This phenomenon reveals a common human trait. When we have accomplished something, regardless of how unimportant it seems, some part of what we have learned during the process remains in us. Some of the forces with which we acted remain connected with the I. This cannot be put any other way, though the way I put it, of course, is only a kind of imagination. We cannot avoid forming certain connections with all the beings we meet and the things we take up, not only physical things, naturally. I am speaking of the things we have some relationship to in life. We each leave our distinctive mark on everything we encounter, and a feeling of connection with those things we have contacted through our actions remains in our subconscious. For criminals, this is expressed abnormally, because their subconscious flashes up very instinctively into ordinary consciousness. But all of us sense in our subconscious that we must return to those places we have encountered through our activities. This, too, is basic to our karma, which arises from it. From this subconscious feeling, at first only nebulous, we have a general feeling of community with the world. We feel this way because we leave our mark everywhere. We can comprehend this feeling, sense it, and perceive it. First, however, we must pay attention to certain intimacies of life. For example, when about to cross a street, we must try to really go into the idea, I am now crossing a street. Then, once we have walked across the street, we continue to imagine ourselves crossing it. By continued exercises like this, we evoke from the depths of our soul a general feeling of community with the world. As consciousness of this feeling of community grows more concrete, it will continue to develop so that eventually one thinks there really is a connection, though invisible, between all things, a connection like that between the members of a single organism. Just as the finger, the earlobes, and indeed every part of our organism are connected with each other, there is also a connection between everything and every event in our world. Modern earthly humanity does not yet have a fully valid consciousness of this feeling of community with all things, an organic penetration into phenomena. It remains unconscious. But in the Jupiter stage of evolution, this feeling will be fundamental, and we are preparing for this as we pass gradually from the fifth to the sixth post-Atlantean era. But this feeling of community must be cultivated now and in the immediate future. It must begin to provide morals and ethics with a definite foundation, morals much more actively related to daily life than today. I mean, for example, that many people today think nothing of enriching themselves at the expense of others. Not only do they live like this with no moral self-criticism, but they simply do not give it a thought. If people were to reflect upon it, they would discover that they live far more at the cost of others than they ever realized. In fact, every one of us lives at the expense of others. In the future, the consciousness will arise that living life at the expense of others has the same effect on a community that an organ has on the body when it develops inappropriately at the expense of another organ. People will realize that individual welfare is really impossible apart from the welfare of the community. Today, of course, there is no inkling of this, but it must gradually become the fundamental principle of true human ethics. Today, people all strive for their own welfare, never thinking that essentially individual welfare is possible only in common with that of everyone else. Thus, there is a connection between the feeling of community I've mentioned and the feeling that the life of the whole community is an organism. The feeling of the whole community as an organism can be enhanced greatly and lead to an intimate feeling of community with all that surrounds us. By enhancing this intimate feeling, we gradually gain the ability to perceive what I described in the previous lecture as the light shining out beyond death into our evolution between death and rebirth, a light we perceive and with which we build our karma. Footnote: that lecture was given in Berlin on March 5, 1918, and is unavailable in English. End of footnote. I want to give a mere hint of this. When we develop this feeling of community, we can do something else as well. We can live with the idiosyncrasies, situations, and thoughts and actions of others as though they were our own. This is related to a certain difficulty in the soul life, one of attuning our thoughts so closely to another, that whatever the other does, thinks, and feels is felt as our own experience. And we are ready to reach the discarnate individual only when we are able to think back fruitfully to what we had in common with the one to whom we were karmically united. This can happen only when we are able to re-experience what we experienced in common with the other soul, even the slightest detail, and to think of it as one thinks when one has this feeling of community. We can picture it this way. We think of something that took place between ourselves and one who has died, how we sat at a table with that person or whatever, no matter how insignificant. But the possibility of entering this experience in the right way so that we get through to the reality will only come to our soul when it is truly suffused with that feeling of community. It will lack the necessary strength otherwise. We must understand that the dead can bring themselves into our consciousness only from a place over which we have cast this, quote, feeling of community, unquote. We can imagine this spatially. However, we must, of course, remain aware that we are forming only an image of it, but that this image is a picture of a reality. Going back to what I said before, We visualize a situation in which we were together with the one who died, how we sat at table with that person, or how we talked together. Turn your whole soul life toward this thought. If in thought we can develop a soul communion with the dead that is in harmony with the, quote, feeling of community, unquote, then our gaze toward the spiritual world can find its way from these thoughts to the reality, just as our thoughts find the reality to which they are directed. If you allow these loving thoughts of the dead person to permeate your soul, then your inward gaze can encounter that soul's gaze. In this way, the one who has died can speak to you. But that speech can come only from the place toward which you direct your feeling of community with that person. This is how these things are connected. We learn to feel our karma, so to speak, when we gain an idea of how we leave behind everywhere the stamp of our thoughts. By learning to identify ourselves with such ideas, we develop the feeling that brings us increasingly conscious union with those who have died. Thus, they are finally able to speak to us. The other requirement is that we should be able to hear what is said and really perceive it when it occurs. We must above all pay attention to what exists as air, so to speak, between us and the dead, so that they can speak to us across it. To use a physical analogy, if the space between us were airless, you would be unable to hear me. Air acts as a medium. Likewise, there must be something between us and the dead before they can approach us. There must be, quote-unquote, spiritual air. We can speak now about the nature of this spiritual air in which we live with the dead. What does it consist of? To understand this, we must recall what I said in other connections about how human memory works, because these matters are all related. Conventional psychology speaks of human memory in one way. For example, I now receive an impression from the external world. It evokes a concept in me, and somehow that concept goes into my subconscious, where it is forgotten. But then, a particular occasion arises. It returns from the subconscious, and I remember. Almost all psychologists believe that a concept arises in us in response to an impression that was quickly forgotten, having sunk into the subconscious until an incident recalls it, then we, quote-unquote, remember. We think we have recalled the concept that we formed initially. This is complete nonsense. It is a bit of nonsense taught in almost all psychology, but nonsense nonetheless. What this describes does not take place at all. When we receive an impression through an outer experience and remember it later, it is not at all the same concept we first formed that arises within us. As we form the concept, a second subconscious process is taking place. It does not come to consciousness during the outer experience, but it takes place nonetheless. And through a course of events which we will not speak of just now, what takes place in our organism today but remains unconscious will take place again tomorrow. Today, the outer impressions evoked the concept, and tomorrow the process which has continued to work below evokes a new concept. A concept I have today passes away and is gone. It no longer stirs my subconscious. But tomorrow, if that same concept arises from my memory, it is because there is something in me that evokes that same concept. Now, however, it is generated subconsciously. Let me say that again. Now, however, it is generated subconsciously. If we imagine that concepts are taken into the subconscious, move about there, and finally emerge from the soul, we should be able to recall what happens if we write out something that we want to remember 3 days later. Do we remain in the notebook and emerge from it after 3 days? The notebook contains only signs, and memory contains only signs that evoke a repetition of what we experienced, though certainly in a weaker form. Footnote: for more on the nature of memory, see An Outline of Esoteric Science, pages 39 to 44, and Anthroposophy and the Inner Life, especially Lecture 9. People who memorize or otherwise try to instill in their mind something they want to retain, those who, quote-unquote, cram, as we called it when we were young, know quite well that perception alone is not enough. Sometimes people must resort to external aids when committing something to memory. Let us observe ourselves when we try to cram. Let us see what efforts we make to aid the unconscious activity that comes into it. We want to find a way to help the subconscious. Here we have two very different processes: committing something to memory and forming an immediate concept of it. If we study people and observe their character, we soon find that even here we are concerned with two kinds of people. There are those who grasp things quickly but have a terrible memory, and there are those whose comprehension is slow but who have a good memory and especially strong faculties of imagination and judgment. These two things may be found side by side, and spiritual science must make the truth of the matter clear. From the time we wake up in the early morning until we fall asleep, we continually perceive something of the world. And when we perceive anything in life, we are more or less conscious of attraction or aversion toward the objects of our perception. And we are usually satisfied once we have grasped something. The activity that leads on to memory, however, is far more extensive than the activity needed to comprehend an impression. Memory takes place at a far more subconscious level in the soul. This subconscious process, proceeding by itself, often contradicts in a remarkable way what happens consciously. We may feel an aversion toward an impression. The subconscious does not feel that antipathy, but usually has feelings that are very different from those of ordinary consciousness. The subconscious develops a remarkable feeling toward all impressions. A phrase from the physical world and applied to the spiritual can be no more than figurative, but here it is appropriate to say that the subconscious develops a certain feeling of gratitude toward every impression, regardless of its nature. It is not inaccurate to say that while your conscious impression of someone may be highly unpleasant, a person may hurl insults in your face, your subconscious impression will still be a certain feeling of gratitude. The simple reason is that anything in life that approaches the deeper aspect of our being, including unpleasant experiences, enriches our life, really enriches it. This has no connection with the way we consciously conduct ourselves toward outer impressions. How we consciously respond to anything has nothing to do with what takes place subconsciously. In the subconscious, everything leads to a certain feeling of thankfulness. There, we receive every impression as a gift, for which we must be grateful. It is extraordinarily important to pay attention to these happenings below the threshold of consciousness. This activity that breaks into a feeling of thankfulness works in a similar way to the effect of an impression that comes to us from the outer world and passes into memory. It goes along side by side with the concept. We can be consciously aware of these things only if we have a distinct feeling that all the time we are awake, we are also dreaming. In my public lecture, I said that in our feeling and will, we continue to sleep and dream, even in waking life. So long as we allow the world to work upon us, we are continually forming our impressions and concepts. But beneath all this, we dream about everything, and this dream life is far richer than we think. It is only eclipsed by our conscious concepts, as is a weak light by a stronger. We can experiment in coming to understand these relationships by paying attention to various intimacies of life. Try the following experiment. Suppose you are lying asleep on a sofa and then wake up. Of course, you do not observe yourself at that moment, because immediately the world makes various impressions upon you, but it may happen that you lie quiet for a time after waking. Then you may observe that you perceived something before you awoke. You can notice this particularly well if someone had knocked at the door and did not repeat the knock. You can confirm by asking, and when you woke up, but when you woke up, you knew that something had happened. It was apparent from the whole situation. When we observe something in this way, we are not far from recognizing what spiritual science can verify, that we perceive unconsciously a far wider range of our environment than is possible consciously. It is quite true that if we are walking along a street and meet someone just coming around the corner, we may feel that we had seen the person just before he or she appeared. Quite often we may have a feeling of having seen something happen before it actually occurs. It is indeed a fact that first we have a psychic spiritual connection with what we later perceive, only we are deafened, as it were, by the later sense of perceptions and do not observe what goes on in the intimacies of soul life. This again is something that takes place of itself subconsciously, like the formation of memory or the feeling of thankfulness toward all surrounding phenomena. The dead can speak to us only through the element that pervades the dreams that are interwoven with our life. The dead speak into these intimate subconscious perceptions that occur on their own, and it is possible for us, given the right conditions, to share with the dead the same spiritual psychic air. If they wish to speak to us, it is necessary that we take into our consciousness something of the feeling of gratitude for all that reveals itself to us. If there is none of this feeling within us, if we are not able to thank the world for enabling us to live, for enriching our life continually with new impressions, if we cannot deepen our soul by often realizing that our entire life is a gift, then the dead will not find a common air with us, for they can speak with us only through this feeling of gratitude. Otherwise there is a wall between us and them. We can see how many obstacles there are to communication with the dead, for, as we know from other connections, it depends on our being karmically united with them. We cannot arouse in ourselves this feeling of gratitude if, having lost them, we wish them back in life. we should be thankful that we had them with us quite irrespective of the fact that we have them no longer. Thus, if we do not have this feeling of gratitude for the beings we wish to approach, they do not find us, or at least they cannot speak to us. The very feelings we so often have toward our nearest dead are a hindrance to their speaking to us. The dead who are not karmically united with us usually have more difficulty in speaking to us, but with those nearest to us we may feel too little gratitude that they have been something to us in life. We should not cling to the idea that we have them no more, for that is an ungrateful feeling in the wider sense of life. If we clearly understand that the feeling of having lost our dead weighs them down, we will keep in mind the whole import of this. When we lose people we love, we must be able to raise ourselves to a feeling of thankfulness that we have had them. We must be able to think selflessly of what they were to us until their death, and not of what we feel now that we have them no more. The better we can feel what they were to us during their life, the sooner will it be possible for them to speak to us through the common air of gratitude. In order to enter more and more consciously into the world whence this all comes, many other things are necessary. Suppose you have lost a child. The necessary feeling of companionship can be brought about by picturing to yourself how you sat and played with the child in such a way that the game was as interesting to you as it was to him or her. When you can do this, you have the appropriate feeling of companionship, for playing with a child has meaning only if one is as much a playmate as the child is. Thus, if we picture ourselves playing with the child and bring the picture to life, the place is created upon which both of our gazes can fall. If we are able to grasp what the dead say, we are in conscious union with them. This, too, can be brought about by many things. For many people, thinking is remarkably easy. You will say, "That is not true." Still, there are some who find it very easy. If people find it difficult, that is really a different feeling. The very people who most regard thinking as easy find true thought most difficult. That is because their thinking is lazy. I mean that most people take their thinking lightly. One cannot say how lightly, because it is so easy for them to think. All one can say is that they just think. They do not acquire a single new idea. That might be too difficult. They merely think. They form their concepts. Then they have them and are content to live with them. Then other things come along, for example, spiritual science. Spiritual science is not avoided by so many people because it is difficult to understand, but because a certain effort is needed to take hold of its ideas, and most people shy away from this. Anyone who progresses in spiritual science gradually observes that to comprehend the thoughts it comprises requires an application of will, just as much as in weightlifting. But people do not want that. They want to think easily. Those who progress in thinking find themselves thinking more and more strenuously, more and more laboriously, as it were, because they learn that to really assimilate a thought, they must make efforts. Nothing is more favorable for penetrating the spiritual world than the experience of finding it harder and harder to grasp the relevant thoughts. Best of all for progress in spiritual science is for people to find they can no longer apply the standards of easy thinking that are customary in daily life, so that they say to themselves, "Thinking of this kind is a really exhausting exercise. It takes as much effort as threshing with a flail." Such a feeling can only be indicated, but it can develop, and this is good and favorable. Many people are so quick with their thinking that it is only necessary to mention a particular point, and they grasp its whole context. They always have a ready answer. What would drawing-room conversations amount to if thinking were difficult? We can, however, observe that as we gradually become acquainted with the inner relationships of things, it becomes more difficult to chatter and be ready with an answer, for that comes from easy thinking. When individuals advance in knowledge, they become more Socratic, so that they have to strain every nerve to gain the right to express an opinion. This feeling that efforts of will go into the grasping of thoughts is related to another feeling we often have when we commit something to memory by cramming and fail to take in what we should. We can experience the relationship between these two things: the difficulty of retaining something in the memory and the difficulty of exerting an effort of will in order to understand something. We can, however, exercise ourselves in this. We can apply what may be called conscientiousness, a feeling of responsibility toward our thinking. It often happens that when, from a certain experience of life, a person says, for instance, quote, "So-and-so is a good man," unquote, the hearer instantly retorts, quote, "An awfully good man," unquote, Just think how often a reply is not positive, but comparative. There is, of course, no reason at all why the answer should be comparative. It comes only from not knowing in the least what to think. We have a feeling that we ought to have had some experience, and that we ought to speak of it. Of course, such a demand must not be pressed too far, or in many drawing-rooms a great silence would settle in. Still, this feeling, which springs from a sense of responsibility toward thinking, and from a recognition that thinking is difficult, opens the way toward the possibility and capacity for receiving inspirations. For an inspiration does not come in the way that thoughts spring up in most people. It always comes when it is as difficult as anything else we find difficult. We must first learn to experience thoughts as difficult, to feel that retaining memories is different from mere thinking. If we do so, we will be able to get a feeling for that weak, dreamlike welling up of thoughts that do not really want to stay, but would rather vanish, thoughts that are difficult to grasp. We can reinforce ourselves by developing a sense of really living with the thoughts. We must clearly realize what goes on in our soul when we intend, for example, to go somewhere and get there. As a rule, we do not think about this, but we should reflect on what has taken place in the world as a result of our having accomplished our purpose and attained what we had in mind. We should also reflect on what takes place in our soul. Often this comes to expression quite strikingly. When mountaineers, for instance, have to exert themselves strenuously to reach a summit and finally arriving exclaim breathlessly, "Thank God I'm here," we feel how the emotions have responded. In this way we can acquire even finer perception, and this delicate perception lives on in the intimacy of the soul. When one begins to recall a shared situation with a friend who has died, trying to unite in thinking and feeling with that friend, the feeling of being on a kind of journey arises. Then a moment comes when one feels as though pausing for a rest after a long walk. This pause can be of tremendous help toward the inspiration such a thought can offer. We can also prepare for inspiration through thoughts by recollecting the whole person, not just the aspect generally expressed in that person's life. Doing this naturally to a stronger and more intimate form... Doing this leads naturally to a stronger and more intimate form of such an experience. Those who succeed in bringing into their consciousness the feeling of gratitude, which would otherwise remain unconscious, will immediately notice that, unlike ordinary gratitude, this gratitude works in such a way that one can unite with the whole person, at least as far as the arms and hands. Here I must remind you of what I've already said about how ordinary concepts are grasped by the brain, but more intimate ideas pass through it as through a sieve, because the hands and arms are in fact organs for apprehending them. One can experience this. Of course, we need not express it externally, but when faced with certain impressions in life, we feel that this gratitude and similar feelings, wonder and awe, for example, can be experienced only through the arms. An unconscious impulse to participate in these impressions stirs in the arms and hands. Such fragmentary expressions of gratitude become evident when people are motivated to clasp their hands together in response to the beauty of nature, or at other times to fold their hands. Everything that happens unconsciously is expressed in life only in a fragmentary way. We can remain physically unmoved in response to this, quote, desire of the hands and arms to be a part of our outer expression, unquote, and move only our etheric hands and arms. As we become more conscious of this and feel outer expressions sympathetically in our own limbs, we develop a feeling that may be expressed this way. When I see red, I am inclined to move my hands in a certain way because those movements belong to that color. If I see blue, I tend to make other movements. The more conscious we become of this, the more we find ourselves developing a feeling for inspirations and impressions that should reach the soul and be retained. When we surrender to playing with children, we lose ourselves in the impression, but we also find ourselves. Then comes the inspiration, if we have prepared ourselves and made our whole being ready to receive the impression. If, when we absorb ourselves in our thoughts with the dead, we are able to bring this absorption into relation with a feeling of solidarity or fellowship, and if, when we emerge from absorption, we can unite this feeling with a true experience of the whole person, I mean an experience of gratitude that is felt to run right down into the arms and hands, then the real spiritual existence, where the dead live between death and rebirth, communicates with the living in such a way that we can say, we find the dead when we can meet in a common spiritual place with a common thought that they also perceive, when we can meet in this shared thought with a feeling of full companionship. The feeling of gratitude is the medium that makes this possible, for the dead speak to the living out of the space woven by the feeling of community, through the air that is created from the feeling of universal gratitude toward the world. It's the end of Lecture 10.